I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick talks to The New Yorker's Amy Davidson Sorkin about the defeat of Roy Moore, the ouster of Al Franken, and how accusations of political misconduct are affecting politics.
Do you think the election, no matter how close, was a turning point in some way for the President of the United States? Taken into context with the results in New Jersey and Virginia and elsewhere.
You mean that he can't win all of the time?
Yeah.
It depends on how he plays it. I don't know if you saw his morning after the election tweet where he basically said,
I predicted it.
The message of this was that Trump was right all along.
Yeah.
And that if only he'd been allowed to play it the way he wanted to, there'd be a Republican in the Senate right now. Is it a turning point in our assessment of Trump's moral capacities? I think there's a lot of things that we knew about him that were very much on display in this. But what we didn't know—
For example?
Well, this is a man who called during the presidential campaign as part of appealing to votes for a complete and total ban on Muslims entering the country. Is it shocking that he would endorse a man who doesn't believe Muslims should enter Congress? There's a lot going on there. But what I think we didn't know about Trump before the Alabama race that we know now is how docile he can make Republican leaders, and how much the mechanisms of the party are indeed in his hands.
The Washington Post originally came out with a story, a very convincing story, with real deep reporting and evidence and interviewing, laying out the case that Roy Moore, a judge, a candidate for the U.S. Senate, and at that time the overwhelming favorite, was given to acts of really repugnant moral behavior. And nevertheless, through right up until the election day, you would hear all kinds of interviews of supporters of Roy Moore who were able to, in their minds, justify continuing their support. One of the ways that was most common was, well, if I vote against Roy Moore, it's open season for abortion, and countless thousands of children will be killed. That was the moral calculus for many people. What did you make of the moral calculus of the Moore voters, and they're willing to tolerate or willingly suspend disbelief about his past?
You know, it's the overused term, fake news. That they didn't believe it. They didn't believe it, or they believed it, or they sort of believed it, or they thought maybe there was some version of it. And what they told themselves about the Democrat, it's part of a larger and troubling question that doesn't only have to do with Alabama. But I also want to go back to one thing you said about the rationalization having to do with reproductive rights. You know, it matters that not only did a Democrat win in Alabama, but a Democrat who did not walk away from his position in favor of reproductive rights, who did not sort of back down on that to the extent that some people in Alabama were practically begging him to do. They're like, just stop about that and you'll have no trouble.
Now, did this particular election shift our understanding of what kind of behavior voters will and will not tolerate in their candidates and in their elected officials?
I mean, you know, in American history, there have been some real...
Anybody compare to Roy Moore?
Who we know about? I mean, you know, we've had times in our history when people were physically assaulting each other on the floor of the Senate. But what I think was striking, and again, is how much somebody who's a wildly eccentric candidate can nonetheless count on the support of his party for quite a while.
Do you think that in politics that Democrats have seized the moral high ground in any way, cumulatively?
I don't think that it belongs to a party at this point. I think that there are individual politicians who've, you know, been out there and taking stands, but I think that it's really too much in flux for there to be real self-congratulation at a certain point. Obviously, you can always say they were worse. But if there's a political party whose only standard is we didn't do that, then you're not very far along.
Did you think the Democratic Party did the right thing of essentially pushing out Al Franken?
It's an interesting question in that what you ideally want is for the voters to have the chance to push people out.
As the employers.
They didn't. Yeah, as the employers. But if you know that you don't have your party's support and you don't have the support of your colleagues, and then you do think as a politician of, you know, if these are actually causes that I believe in and it's not about me, then you think about who could be appointed to your job. But I'm sorry that in his speech he was so deflecting. Again, it was this, why me and not Trump? And I don't think that that's the right approach at this moment.
Why?
Well, because it gets you into a couple of not great places, one of which is, you know, there's always somebody worse. There's always going to be something worse, and it ups what you're going to tolerate. And the other is that I think one of the big problems we have now, and we've talked about this before, is how disreputable politics seems as a profession, you know, and if it's like, this is how it works, this is how Congress is, this is what you put up with if you want this guy who's going to vote for that, that's a terrible place for us to be in as a democracy. And I would also say about Franken, though, and the Democratic Party, that I think one role he played, fairly or unfairly, was being the party has a lot of unfinished business with Bill Clinton, you know, and in some ways, Al Franken was a proxy for that.
That, you know, Al Franken was somehow sacrificed to the overlooking of the sins of Bill Clinton in the past.
I think there was a feeling that really too much had been overlooked. In that, and that it hurt the party, it had hurt its standing, it had hurt Hillary Clinton's chances in 2016. And I think that there was an unpaid debt there, and there wasn't a lot to draw on. You know, thinking back also to the Clinton period, you know, when Clinton, you know, who was impeached and went through a Senate trial— and was acquitted. His trial was taking place, one of his defenders was Dale Bumpers, who was the senator from Arkansas, one of them from Bill Clinton's home state. And he gave a speech that was very memorable at the time, in which he basically said at one point, you know, when somebody tells you it's not about sex, it's about sex. And his point then was everybody who was saying, oh, it's not about Bill Clinton's affair, it's about lying, it's about perjury, it's about obstruction of justice, that they weren't telling the truth. That was just about sex. I think that what we have now is a really different understanding of that phrase and a different understanding of these dynamics. Now when, for example, the Harvey Weinstein story, when people say now it's not about sex, what they often mean is that the sex itself is not about sex. It's about violence. It's about power. It's about misuse of power. And I think that the complexities of that have really changed over the years, even the phrases that we use and what we tolerate.
What do you think is really going to lead to real substantive change, whether it's in the realm of politics or any other realm?
Looking at politics specifically, and I always think this is true, it's going to be the voting booth. It's got to be. That's where the costs have to be levied.
Meaning more women in power.
There needs to be more women who are elected. There needs to be a political cost to each party for all of that. It's, you know, if there's a, if you think of Congress as a job market or any kind of a market, things have to have a real price. Otherwise, it gets all out of whack. And, you know, some of the things we're hearing about in Congress seem to have to do with these unspoken economies of power and access. And
for example,
there's been a lot of reporting about you have a place where there are a lot of young people who aren't paid very much, who are far from home making connections. You also have lobbyists. You have money. You have a lot of what goes on in Congress is off the books. And it gets tricky, and that might be true in any closed system like that. And to make it less closed, to make it, you know, more transparent, to help people know what they're voting for, and for, you know, also to have parents look at all of this and want their children to go into politics. Because if it keeps seeming so seedy, who are the congressmen in 20 years going to be? Who is that? Who's drawn to that profession? Is that what you would aspire to, or aspire to as a career? And if not, who's going to be running the country?
Amy Davidson Sorkin, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
That was Amy Davidson Sorkin talking to David Remnick.